Right, so we're talking about this topic, and I've called it a thorough investigation, and you'll see why I've called it that. Here's the question. When you see, maybe you haven't seen, you see reports about how the church is in decline in the UK and in the Western world. Now, here's my question. Does that surprise you? Should it surprise us? Should it surprise us that people are walking away from faith? Should it surprise us that some people are reducing their faith down to going through the motions instead of following Jesus? Because in today's rational society, isn't that a rational response? Just think about these questions. Because aren't we just more sophisticated now? Aren't we more sophisticated than just to believe because the Bible says we should? You see, I grew up and the answer I received to anything was the Bible says. And we were doing a feedback from people who've joined the church in the last 12 to 15 months. And I was shocked at some of the things that they said. And one of the things that came, particularly from the younger ones that we talked to, so 20s, 30s, was this. When you use jargon, it turns me off. I stop listening. That generation has like an anti-jargon sensor. And I said, well, what's jargon? And there were some things that, you know, I thought would be in there, and they are in there. But one that really surprised me is, Mark, when you say the Bible says, I stop listening. And I said, why would you do that? Because for my generation, that's just the same as saying the Quran says or Buddha says. Why should I believe it just because the Bible says? It's just a book, okay? And that's why we're doing this series. Because the Bible is a book. Your faith is not grounded on the Bible. The Bible is not the object and center of your faith. And I'm going to explain why that is. Because this is why so many people's faith is falling over. Because just like Cheryl with her granddad, whenever Cheryl would question anything or whenever she had a doubt, her granddad would respond, well, that's just faith. You just have to believe what the Bible says. And that's okay when you're young. But when you grow up and the world's a lot more complicated, just saying I have to believe because the Bible says won't get me through. It won't get me through the challenges. And I can see already that some of you are concerned about what I'm going to say, and you're kind of like, where's he going with this? Well, the reason I'm doing this is because this is very real. Because people base their faith on the wrong foundation. There is a big research project that has been done amongst churches about the way that a believer grows and the way that they develop as believers. So some of it's really obvious. You know, they hear about Jesus, they decide they want to follow Jesus. They then spend the next few years working out how it all works and how you fit in at church and what the rules and accumulating knowledge and accumulating information. So they've got a picture about what it means to be a follower of Jesus. Then the next thing that happens is that they put in starts coming out and they start serving, they start helping people, they start blessing people. But nearly, and I think that there was no exceptions in this survey, everybody at some point had a crisis in their life where that simple faith didn't work for them. And so they had to find and dig down and say, what is it that I really believe? And I remember doing that several times in my life where I've gone, I just don't get all this church stuff. I just don't get all this Christian stuff. I don't, you know, like all these sort of things. And I dug down, what is my faith based on? What is it that is an immovable object that I can anchor to? And I'm going to explain what that is, the answer that I found. And the answer that everybody who comes through that crisis of faith finds. So, here's what happens. The foundation of our faith is more real than a collection of ancient manuscripts that were put into a book. There are lots of collections of ancient manuscripts in books. But the foundation of our faith is far more substantial. It's far more sustainable than just a collection of literature. And the reason for that is that our faith is investigable. Here's the point. Now, you're going like, that's not a real word. And I thought, that's not a real word. I thought it's investigatable. But it's not. It's investigable. That's actually the right word. I mean, they put the other one in the dictionary now because everybody kept getting it wrong. But apparently, that's the right word. Our faith is investigable, which means it can stand up to scrutiny. That means, and maybe you find yourself in this place. Maybe this is where you are. Maybe you're going like, I don't even know if I want to listen to all this stuff about Jesus. I don't know where everybody is in this room. And some of you might be going, well, I'm not really sure, not as sure as I used to be. This means it's okay to ask questions. It's okay to ask questions. And as Christians, in responding to those questions, we don't have to go, it's a mystery, you just have to believe it. We don't, because that's not the reality of what our faith is based on. Here's the point. Real Christians do not have blind faith. Real Christians have a faith that is solidly grounded. And so we don't have to be embarrassed when people ask questions and express doubt. We can be real. And we don't have to respond like Cheryl's granddad used to, which is, well, you just have to take faith by faith. And part of the problem we've experienced in the church world is there's a lot of people who've been putting faith in faith instead of putting faith in Jesus. And the two are very different. Here's the point. The Christian faith does not rise or fall on a series of ancient documents, or on the presence of church structures, or on the traditions, or all the things that we've accumulated over the centuries. The Christian faith does not rise and fall on any of that. The Christian faith rises or falls on the identity of a single individual. Christian faith rises or falls on the identity of a single individual. So if you're curious about faith, or you're returning to faith, or you're not sure about faith, then this series is good news for you. Because I'm even going to give you the question you should ask. It might take you by surprise, but I'm trying to lead you down a path. And here's the question you should ask. Is Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, not and John, or John, any of them, is Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John a reliable account of actual events? Because even if one of those is a reliable account of actual events, and what they say about Jesus is true, then game on. We have something solid that we can anchor our faith to. We're not following an instruction book anymore. We're following a person. So here's the Christian story in a nutshell. And the reason I'm going to tell you this is this throws people when they find this out. But it won't throw you anymore. Okay? Here's the Christian story in a nutshell. My little diagram with little clip, you know, cartoony people. Okay. So here's how the Christian faith evolved. This thing that we are now sat here because of. Number one, there was an event. And that event is the resurrection of Jesus. So there's an event. And immediately after that event, a movement started. Against all the odds, a movement came along calling itself the Way. And eventually, it overcame the greatest empire the world has ever seen. And immediately on that movement starting, people who were part of that movement started to write things down. They started sending letters to each other. They started putting down accounts of what they'd seen, what they'd heard, and what they knew. And then something else happens. Because all those accounts, everything that you now call the New Testament, that all occurred in like 35 to 40 years after Jesus' resurrection, after the event. So by the time we get to the documentation, we're really close to the event, and everybody who's writing it was there at the time. They saw it. What you've got we call the Bible comes along 400 years later. When all those documents were gathered together, all those letters were gathered. And so the Bible doesn't come along 400 years after Jesus, and it's not kind of made up and, you know, anybody could have said anything in the Chinese whispers. The stuff that's in the Bible actually came along when the people were still living who were there, who saw it. It just gets collected 400 years later. Right, so why is that important? What's the reason why that's important? Well, here it is. The story of Jesus is not a Bible story. The story of Jesus is not a Bible story. The story of Jesus is why there's a Bible in the first place. The event and the person drives the document. It's not a story just so that we can read it. Jesus is the reason for the Bible. And so the story of Jesus isn't just another cool story to read and tell the kids about. It's a fact that you can thoroughly investigate. And that's why we don't have blind faith. Our faith is based on a real person and a real historical event that can be thoroughly investigated. And it stands up. So when you go down and you say, what does my faith stand on? It doesn't stand on, can I remember some verses of the Bible that I learnt when I was six? It stands on a real event that you can investigate. Here's some clever people. How many people here are not from Cambridge? Not from Cambridgeshire, then. Okay. Phew. Okay. Here's the reason I ask that. If you're not from Cambridgeshire, this doesn't apply. But if you're from Cambridge particularly, you're really clever. Okay? Really clever people in Cambridge, isn't it? We all know that. We all know there's famous, really clever people in Cambridge, of which we're all included. All included. We're all really clever people. But there are cleverer people than most of us. And because we like Cambridge, I thought I'd get the opinions of some people who were very famous Cambridge people. So here's the first one. This guy's called Bishop Westcott. And his job at Cambridge University, he was a textual critic. So basically, he looked at ancient documents and said, is this likely to be accurate or not? And that's what he used to lecture in. Now, he was also... For those who are interested in this, Joanna, he was a Norrison Prize winner. And basically, there's this group in Cambridge University that's kind of like a little inner group, and it gets renewed every year, of 12 boffins. And because there's 12 of them, they call them the Cambridge Apostles. And he was one of those, and he got double first. And, like, he's quite clever, would you agree? This is what he said at the end of his investigation. Taking all the evidences together, it's not too much to say that there is zero historical incidents better or more variously supported than the resurrection of Jesus. Now, we have to take that seriously, don't we? Because that's what a person who is trained in this concludes. And he's lecturing, or did lecture, people how to do this, how to do this textual criticism. Then, just in case you haven't heard of Bishop Westcott, I've got somebody more famous. Now, admittedly, he left the faith and went to Oxford. No, he didn't leave the faith, he just went to Oxford. But he was at Cambridge. And his name is C.S. Lewis. And apart from writing The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and a few other books, he was a professor of medieval and Renaissance literature at Cambridge University. So he's a boffin as well. And this is what he said. There's no such historical claim in religion as in Christianity. I am too experienced in literary criticism to regard the Gospels as a myth. And then, just in case we kind of don't believe Cambridge people, there's another guy, and he's called Frederick Kenyon. He's the director and principal librarian of the British Museum. Well, he was. And he was also the president, like the top guy of the British Academy. You know, all the academics. He's the top guy. And this is what he says. The interval between the dates of original composition and the earliest evidence is so small as to become, in fact, negligible. And the last foundation for any doubt that the scriptures have come down to us as originally written is now removed. Both the authenticity and the general integrity of the books of the New Testament may be regarded as fully established. Remember the question you should ask. Is either Matthew, Mark, Luke or John an accurate and reliable account of Jesus' life? This guy who's top of this academic institute called the British Academy, librarian, British Museum, says, absolutely without doubt. It's reliable, it's accurate. Just to put that in context, because it's a very pretty diagram, I don't expect you to read it, because it's got pictures. But what you'll see is there, on the first line in the box at the side, it says, well, the New Testament was all written down in like these letters and documents and accounts within 40 to 70 years of, we've got them. They exist. We've got these documents within that date to within 40 to 70 years of the resurrection. If you compare that with other stuff that people read, let's say the next biggest, which is Homer's Iliad, the earliest document between when that was written and that we have available, that you can actually go and look at, is 500 years. And yet, people read the Iliad. And all these great people, you know, like Plato. Heard of Plato? The earliest one document we have of Plato's is 1,400 years after actually he lived. And yet we've got all these documents about Jesus within 40 to 70 years of his resurrection. Not only that, we have 24,000 of those that are spread out all around the world and in museums and things. The next best is Homer's Iliad, with which is 643. Again, 500 years afterwards. Can you see that this is investigable? That our faith doesn't stand on a book. Our faith stands on a real person and a real event, and he was who he said he was. Okay, let's go back to my diagram, my little cartoony diagram. So what we need to understand is this. If there had been no resurrection, there would have been no movement and there would have been no church and no Bible. Put that the other way around. The only way that the church exists and the Bible exists and that movement starts in the conditions it started in is because there was a resurrection in which Jesus proves he was who he said he was. Right, don't take my word for it. We're going to look over the next 4 weeks at the Gospel of Luke. Luke was a doctor. Doctors are really clever people, aren't they? Yeah? They train. And Luke was highly trained. He's very smart. And we're going to find that he had personally some conversations with Jesus' disciples, personal conversations with Jesus' family, and lots of eyewitnesses. Now, here's the thing. When you're writing something down, the first thing you say is really important, isn't it? Yeah? You want to get it right. So Luke's going to write something down. You want to get that opening sentence right. Have you ever tried to write a story or a letter or something or even an email and it's important and you want to get it right? And you kind of like delete and rewrite and delete and rewrite that opening sentence or the opening couple of sentences till you get it right, yeah? So Luke's opening sentence is really important. In fact, Luke's gospel and what he says is so good that even the first word is important. Here's the first word. The first thing Luke writes in his gospel. There you are. Many. Many. And he's going to say many people have written down accounts. Many. How many is many? 4. Is it 10? How many is many? It's a lot, isn't it? So he's aware that there's lots of things that are written down and lots of other people have written accounts about Jesus. Many people wrote down what they saw. That's why we have 24,000 of these things going around. Now, they're not the originals, they're copies. I'll come on to that in a minute. You see, if you're going to make something up or you're going to tell a lie, the last word you use as your first word is many. Because the first thing somebody's going to come and say to you is, show me the many, who's the many? Who are they? Why do they write? You don't start something that's made up with that word. Here's another thought. Unless you do something extraordinarily great or extraordinarily horrible, how many people 2,000 years later would know you existed? Unless you do something extraordinary, why would anybody 2,000 years later know you existed? Let alone write an account of your life. How many of you know who the ruler of the Roman Empire was? Emperor at that time when Luke's writing this. How many of you know who it was? No, it's not Nero. Any more guesses? Pardon? Yeah, it's Caesar. It is a Caesar. Yeah, good. Pardon? Not Julius, no. You see, we can't even reach a consensus or even an educated guess about who the Caesar was, the ruler of the biggest empire in the world at the time this is getting written. I'll put you out of your misery. It was Tiberius Caesar. And what do we know about Tiberius Caesar? Virtually nothing. Virtually nothing. There's hardly any historical documents or any information that we have about Tiberius Caesar. So the most powerful man in the world at that time, there's nothing about him. We don't know anything. He just kind of sits there between Augustus and Caligula and Claudius. And we know more about them, but not a lot more. But we know a lot about Jesus. Why do you think that is? I'll let you think about that. How many narratives do you think there are in the world about ancient peasants and criminals? Lots of books about them, would you think? Or none? So why in the world would Luke bother to investigate and bring us an account, and I'm trying not to be disrespectful here, but of a Galilean day laborer who turned rabbi, was executed by the empire, and even his own followers deserted him? Why would you bother? You would bother because something extraordinary happened. And not just extraordinary, but good for everybody. Not bad news, good news, extraordinary good news happened. That's the only reason you would do this. So, I'm not going to, obviously, if I'm going to preach one word at a time, we're going to be here till I die, basically, I'm going through Luke. So let's go on to the next word. What's the next sentence? Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. Think about that. He's saying, this happened in my lifetime. This happened in your lifetime. You saw it. You heard about it. You can go and talk to people who were there. You can go and talk to the guy that stuck his finger in Jesus' wounds. You can go and talk to the guy who denied him three times. You can go and talk to John, who stood at the foot of the cross and then was in the room when Jesus was resurrected. You can talk to these people because this happened among us. What he's saying is, guys, just imagine that Jesus was resurrected in front of our church this morning. Somebody you had seen murdered by the Romans, and there he is, 3 days later, he stood in front of you. This happened among us. That's what he's saying. We saw it. And so we're writing it down. Because we saw it. And if you don't believe me, go and ask people. Because if you didn't see it, your next door neighbour saw it. Because this happened among us. And like that diagram, my lovely diagram with all the balls on, almost all of ancient history that we have is written hundreds and hundreds of years after the event. By piecing together little bits And trying to construct a story about it. But this is written there and then by the people who saw it. So, let's carry on. Just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first. What's he saying there? Here's what he's saying. He's saying, I didn't just investigate the end of the story. I investigated it right from the beginning. That's why in the book of Luke, you see all the accounts about Elizabeth and Zachariah and Mary and what happened and what they said and what they prayed. Why? Because Luke went and down and he sat in front of them, just like I'm in front of June, and he asked questions. And June, Elizabeth or Mary answered them and he wrote them down. He said, this is what happened. And he asked Elizabeth and he said, how do you know? And she said, because I was there. And my family was there. And my husband was there. And it all happened like that. And he sat in front of people and he's interviewing them. So then he says this. Just as they were handed down to us from those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Now, that's a bit technical. In the Bible, they often refer to Jesus as the word. It was kind of the name they used. So they're saying these were eyewitnesses, and they were became followers of Jesus. And what he's saying is, I've interviewed everyone I can because I wanted to make sure. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't saying anything that wasn't true. And then in verse 3, he says this, with this in mind, since I myself, here's the title for this series, have thoroughly investigated everything from the beginning, I too decide to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus. Okay? Thoroughly. Original language, what's getting translated there? Here's what thoroughly is in the original language. Perfectly, diligently, exactly. I have perfectly, diligently, and exactly investigated. And that word investigated, original language, I've examined all the evidence. It means attended to the evidence, followed through on that evidence in order to get a full understanding. That's what he's saying there. I've done this. I've bothered this to death. I've investigated everything I can get my hands on, everybody I can talk to. And the result of that is I've written an orderly account. My purpose was to put the things that you've heard about and you believe in and your faith is founded on in order so that you can believe. And so here's what it does. Luke does not think he is writing the Bible. He doesn't even know there will be a Bible. He's writing a thoroughly investigated piece of evidence for an official who he's working for. Here's the thing, and this is really important. The Gospel of Luke is included in the Bible because it was found to be accurate. It didn't become reliable when it was included in the Bible. That's important. It was included in the Bible because it was known to be reliable and valuable and accurate. That's why it gets in there. So if Luke thoroughly investigated all this from the beginning, then what should we respond? We should lean in. We should be going, okay, I need to listen. I need to think about this. I need to work out what this does, how this impacts my life. Because something extraordinary happened. And what happened is good for you, good for me, and good for everybody. And what becomes clear when you read Luke's gospel and when you read his follow-up, which is called the Book of Acts, when you read those, it's absolutely clear that Luke believed everything he wrote down in there and he believed it was absolutely accurate. So we come to the end of this passage, and this is what it says, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. Now that's where I started this talk. We can be taught things, but we need to know what we're believing in or who we're believing in. And his purpose in writing this was that those Theophilus wouldn't be left with the impression that Christianity is all about faith in faith. You just have to believe. He wanted Theophilus to know, no, you don't just have to believe. This is real stuff. This really happened. Jesus really was who he said he was. Jesus really rose from the dead. Jesus really ascended into heaven in front of us all. That's what we believe. That's what we die for. That's what he's saying. You know, when that event occurred of Jesus raising from the dead and launching that movement, the church was born. And Luke has this document. They're not like books. Like, they're not even pieces of paper like this. They're ancient scrolls and tablets and things. And he's got this letter that he's sending to Theophilus. And that letter gets copied several times by him. And he takes it around with him. Now, do you know what happened between that movement starting, this getting documented, and 400 years later, when the Bible gets collated? Christianity takes over the Roman Empire. But in the meantime, every single Caesar who comes along recognizes that these documents written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and others are ticking bombs. And they try and get rid of them. And if they find people with them, they kill the people and burn the documents. So what's happening is Christians are busily writing down over and over again multiple copies of these documents in case somebody who's got one gets executed and the document gets burnt just for having the document. And that goes on for 350 years plus until one woman turns to Christianity, and she just happens to be the mother of the emperor, Constantine. And she's brave enough to tell the emperor about what she believes, tell her son about what she believes. And he turns to Christianity, and he orders all the documents in all the world, as many as he can get, to be brought into one place, and he puts all the scholars he can find to study those documents before they go in the Bible. You see, people worry about what if it all got changed? What if stuff got added? That's what he was worried about. But that's not what happened. Because if you've got a document that potentially is going to cost you your life, and it tells about the most important event in history that was written down by eyewitnesses to that event, you make really sure there's no errors. When you look at all those 24,000 copies, here's what you find. These are two guys who studied this, looked at it, did the same as Constantine did. They're called Geisler and Nix. This is what they concluded. Only a few lines are in doubt, compared to 764 different things, thousands and thousands of words in Homer's Iliad. We actually don't know what Homer wrote at all. But the Bible, 24,000 things survived right across the Roman Empire, and there's only a few lines of difference in all those things. Here's what you find. Not one single doctrine of Christian faith rests on any of those differences. We can be absolutely certain our faith rests on a real person, and there was a real event that started a movement that changed the world. And Luke's saying, and I wrote it down. So you should lean in. You should think, how's that going to affect my life? Because if what that guy this morning, Mark, is saying at the front of church is true, which it is, then you've got to think deeply about what that means for you.